Right, brethren, I've got the nod, so we're okay to continue. And today is going to be the final part, I believe, part five of our study of the book of Job. And it's entitled Job's Happy Ending, because he did indeed have a happy ending after some rather difficult times before that. And when we started, I guess it was 4 or 5 weeks ago, we said that the most common view of Job and his experiences was really Job was a good man. He was perfect and upright, but for some reason God wanted to teach a lesson about the value of suffering. And so for whatever reason, God pointed Job out to Satan and said to Satan, basically, go on, Satan, there's my top man, now give him your best shot. See if you can cause him to sin and curse me. And that sort of is the message, apparently, and we know that Satan failed. And presumably we've all got to learn some sort of lesson about the value of suffering patiently. And that, I think, is what most people see the story of Job to be all about. Is that very inspiring? Perhaps not, because after all, bearing in mind that we don't ever know what God's going to do, what would happen if he hits us with a massive suffering and loss? Perhaps strikes us down with a chronic illness, or kills our spouse or our children. Perhaps God will cause us to lose our homes or our jobs. Is it simply that we just need to accept these calamities in our lives and quote scripture? Well, the Lord gives and the Lord is taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And then we just learn to suffer patiently and gracefully. Not that most of us ever would suffer particularly gracefully or patiently, but that's sort of the common view of the book of Job. And hopefully by now we've seen that's not really an accurate presentation at all. Quick recap, we saw that Satan actually planned all along an attack on Job, for which God actually rebuked him. And God said, have you set your heart on my servant Job? And we've seen that to set your heart on in the book of Job means with some sort of malicious intent. It was a very negative connotation. In fact, last week we saw that, you know, Job said to God, have you set your heart on me? Because Job thought God was after him. And we saw earlier on that Satan goes about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. He did it in Job's day, and in fact he's doing it today. You know, Satan is still roaming around the earth, walking to and walking fro, seeking whom he may devour. He had Job for a while, and of course he's looking at you and he's looking at me. We saw also that God acknowledged to Satan that actually, Satan, look, behold, all that Job has is in your power. At which point, you know, Satan realized it, went out and attacked. And Job lost his herds, his flocks, his wealth, all his children were killed. That was what we covered in Job chapter 1. And then we saw that Job made a big mistake when he ignorantly attributed all of his calamities to God, even though it was actually Satan who was doing them. Let's turn to Job chapter 1, just refresh our memory. Job chapter 1, and we'll begin in verse 8. Job chapter 1, beginning in verse 8. Then the Eternal said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, meaning as in the Hebrew, have you set your heart on my servant Job? Are you focusing on Job as a target? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. So Satan answered the Eternal and said, well, yeah, but does Job fear God for nothing? Huh? Verse 10, have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. Now, I don't personally think that God had put a hedge around Satan, around Job, sorry, but clearly Satan thought that was the case. Verse 11, but notice this. But now, says Satan, stretch out your hand and you touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. So Satan was trying to get God to reach out his hand and strike Job. Satan was inciting, provoking, but obviously God would not be taken by that. Verse 12, for the Eternal said to Satan, behold, or look, or see, because that's all the word behold means, see, all that he has is in your power. Only, do not lay a hand on his person. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Eternal, and we know what took place thereafter. Goodbye to the herds, the flocks, the wealth, and of course even Job's 10 children were killed when the home they were in collapsed. And then dropping down to verse 20, when Job heard all the news, he said, he arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped, and he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Eternal gave, that would be true, and the Eternal has taken away, which would be false, because it was Satan that had taken all away. Blessed be the name of the Eternal. So we covered all that in the previous two or three weeks. We also saw, if you recollect, that Job had a major problem. He left himself wide open to Satan's attacks, because we turn to Job chapter 3 and verse 25. Job had a serious flaw that allowed Satan to get through and attack him. Notice chapter 3 and verse 25. Job says, for the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. So Job didn't just have fear, it said he had great fear. He lived in dread of calamity happening to him. Now, he should not have done, because we said before, you know, that fear is belief. Fear is belief in bad things happening. Fear is a perverted form of faith. You know, faith is trusting God for good things, and fear is trusting for bad things happening. You could re-quote Hebrews 11 as, you know, fear is the substance of things dreaded, the evidence of things not seen. So to live in fear, to live in fact in great fear, and to live in dread, is to leave yourself open to attack. And just as faith is in two places, in the heart and in the mouth, likewise fear is in two places, in the heart and in the mouth, because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So we can imagine that Job would have spoken his fears, because he feared greatly and he dreaded, and out of the abundance of dread and fear in his heart, he would have spoken, no question, and Satan would have heard. And so we saw that fear was a major problem in Job's life also. We've seen that Job lacked knowledge. Elihu said so, God said so, and Job latterly acknowledged, yep, I lacked knowledge, or at least he lacked accurate knowledge. And then the third thing is that Job was in many ways presumptuous. He thought that leading a good life would provide protection for him in all circumstances. And that's presumption. Presumption is believing that God will do something that he's never said he'll do. That's presumptuous. Now, faith is believing that God will do what God has said he will do. That's faith. Presumptuousness is believing that God will do something when he's never said he'll do something. And Job clearly thought that because he was a good and upright man, he would be preserved and protected. Now, he wasn't, and indeed, neither will you be nor will I be. We can think because we're good people, because we are Sabbath keepers, because we are members of God's one and only true church, that somehow that means we'll be preserved and protected automatically. That's presumptuousness or presumption. It doesn't happen. Didn't happen to Job, won't happen to you. To keep your place there for a moment, you can see one good example. If you turn to Revelation chapter 12 and verse 13, if you think that living good equals preservation, protection, then here's an illustration of how that is not the case. Revelation chapter 12, beginning in verse 13, a prophecy of something yet to happen. It says, verse 13, "Now when the dragon," that's Satan, "saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman," which we take to be the church, "was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent." But dropping down to verse 17, "And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ." So here are people who are good people. It says these are people who keep the commandments, who have the testimony of the Lord Jesus Christ. These must be Sabbath keepers, Feast of God keepers, keepers of God's law. It says they are those who keep the commandments. And what's happening to them? Well, they're not in the place of safety, and Satan is making war on them. So is that protection? Nope. They've missed out on protection, because those who've gone to the place of safety are being protected from the face of the serpent. So here are people who are good people, who are commandment-keeping people, and they're facing the wrath of Satan the devil. There's one place you can see alone that being a good person doesn't guarantee you protection and preservation. It requires some other things. Okay, let's go back to Book of Job. Now we saw the story of Job's three friends, and of course they had the answer. They knew what the problem was. Job was a wicked sinner. He was a hypocrite. He was guilty of exploiting poor people. He deserved all he got, and in fact he deserved more than he got from God, because clearly everybody could see that God was punishing him, and it was all God behind it. And all that Job had to do was simply repent of his wickedness, return to God, and God would bless him. That was the story of Job's three friends. And then I think it was last week we saw Job's view, and Job said, "I'm innocent of any serious transgression. You know, God's wounding me without a just cause. If only God would turn up and answer me. If only I had a mediator between me and God." So let's have a quick resume of what Job said. Job chapter 9 and beginning in verse 17. This is Job speaking. As I said before, if you just colour in the name of the speaker in the early part of each chapter, you can quickly pick up whether it's Job or Elihu or God or Eliphaz or whoever. But here it's Job, and he says, verse 17, talking of God, "For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause." As far as Job is concerned, this is God. And God is multiplying my wounds, and he has no cause. He has no reason. It's just not right that God would do this to me. Now, of course, it wasn't God, as we know, but Job at this stage didn't. Look at chapter 10 and verse 2. "I will say to God, do not condemn me. show me why you contend with me. And he wants God to turn up and speak to him and explain, why are you doing this to me? You know, stop it. Look at verse 7. Although you know, God, that I am not wicked, and yet there's no one who can deliver from your hand. Your hands have made me and fashioned me an intricate unity, yet you would destroy me. You know, God, you know I'm not wicked, and yet you're out to destroy me. It's just not right. Look at verse 20. Are not my days few? Cease. Leave me alone, that I may take a little comfort. You know, go away. Stop this. You know, put an end to it. Cease. Desist. So, you know, poor old Job, in a sense, he's quite confident in his own mind that God's beating him up. And he says, there's no reason, there's no cause. I've done nothing, you know, seriously wrong. This is unjust. Look at chapter 13 and verse 3. But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God. So he's talking to his three friends, and he says, I want to speak to God. You know, I want to get in front of God and explain my case to him. Look at verse 18. See now, I have prepared my case, and I know I shall be vindicated. I'm going to turn up in the law courts of heaven, and I've got my story already. I've got my facts at hand, and I know that when the court of heaven hears, I will be vindicated. I am innocent. I've done nothing wrong. God's doing this without any reason. It's just not fair. That's Job's view. Look at chapter 23. And picking up in verse 1. Then Job answered and said, even today my complaint is bitter. My hand is listless because of my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I would come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. If I just knew where God was, I'd get there, and I'd have the whole story, and I'd lay the facts in front of him, and then it would be clear. And so that's Job's view. I'm innocent of any great transgression, and it's not that Job pretended he had no sin. What Job meant by all this was that, you know, I've done nothing particular, nothing that stands out that deserves this type of punishment. I mean, clearly I've sinned like most folk, but essentially I'm a good and blameless and upright man. And of course, that was the case. God himself said so in Job chapters 1 and 2. So Job had been right to defend his integrity. But of course, he wasn't being punished by God in the first place, and it wasn't because of any sin in the second place. It was the Satan, just doing what Satan always does, looking for those whom he may devour. And Job had left the door, you know, wide open. So it's time today to look at God's response, because God eventually turns up and sorts things out. We're going to actually skip over the words of Elihu. He was a young man, and we find his story in chapters 34, 5, 6, and 7. But to save a bit of time, we won't cover that. I think it doesn't particularly detract from the story by missing him out. Due apologies to young Elihu. But before we turn to God's intervention and what God had to say, we need to just pick up some points from Job chapter 2. So we turn back to Job chapter 2. I think we went through chapter 2 very quickly early on, but a couple of 3 points to pull out here. So we'll start in verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Eternal, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Eternal. Looks like he was summoned, perhaps the others were too. And the Eternal said to Satan, from where do you come? This is a repeat, pretty much, of what we saw in chapter 1. So Satan answered and said, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it. Which is precisely what Peter tells us that the devil goes about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Nothing new here. Verse 3, then the Eternal said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Or, the Hebrew says, have you set your heart on my servant Job? And it has a negative connotation. It hints at, for no good reason, for evil. Have you set your heart on my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause? So, let's carry on for a moment or two. So Satan answered the Eternal and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now, and you touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. So, once again, as Satan's trying hard to get God to do the dirty work, well, you stretch out your hand. If you look at Job chapter 1 and verse 11, there Satan had said, but now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. You know, what Satan was trying to do was trying to incite God to do the dirty work. So in verse 3, the latter part of verse 3, it says, God says to Satan, still he holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. You incited me. Other translations say you enticed me, or you provoked me to destroy him without cause. Now, what do you think God would do if Satan tried to provoke him? What would God do if Satan tries to incite him to do something? What would God do if Satan tries to entice God to do evil? Well, you know what he'd do. He would refuse. There's no way that God would yield to Satan's provocation or incitement. I mean, God tells us not to yield to Satan. We're commanded to resist Satan's wiles and stratagems. You're still not going to find that God is going to fall for them. It's just not God's nature to be tricked by or to yield to any incitement or enticing or provocation of Satan the devil. God's way above that. We can see that if we check in a couple of moments elsewhere. But the word here, incited, in verse 3 in my New King James Version, it's movedst me in the King James. I think others put entice. That is the Hebrew word sooth. That would be S-U-T-H. S-U-T-H, sooth. We can see that if we hold a place here, but turn to Deuteronomy chapter 13 and beginning in verse 6. If you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 13 and verse 6. And here is a warning to the people of Israel. It says, verse 6, if your brother, the son of your mother, your son or your daughter, the wife of your bosom, or your friend who is as your own soul, secretly entices you, same word, this is the word, sooth, can be incites, entices you, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known, neither you nor your fathers, of the gods of the people which are all around you, near to you or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. Verse 8, you shall not consent, or Martin says, yield to him, or listen to him. Nor shall your eye pity him, nor shall you spare him or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. So instruction here is, if you're a very close member of your family, or your church group, or whoever secretly entices you, secretly incites you to be disobedient, verse 8, you shall not consent to him. You shall not yield. In other words, being enticed is what the tempter does, but we don't have to respond. or give in, I should say. We should respond and say, no, we resist temptation, we resist Satan, we resist his incitement, his enticing, whether it's directly or through other people. It says here, if your brother secretly entices you, provokes you, or incites you to do evil, you shall not yield. So back to the book of Job, it'd be quite evident to me at least, that when Satan entices or incites God, I know what God's going to say. N-O, no way. God doesn't want us to yield to Satan. He doesn't set the example by himself yielding to Satan. And if you remember the days later in the New Testament, after Jesus had fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, it says that Satan, the tempter, came to him. And again, same old story. Tried to entice Jesus to worship him. Tried to provoke Jesus to leap off the pinnacle of the temple. Didn't succeed, because Jesus is the same in the book of Job as he was in the Gospel of Matthew, and said, no, away with you. And so it's quite evident to me that God did not respond to the cheek or the arrogance of Satan. So carrying on a little bit, verse 6. So the Eternal said to Satan, behold, or look, see, he is in your hand, but spare his life. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Eternal and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he, Job, took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God? And shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. At no point did Job curse and do what many of us might have done. And if that's what God you are, you can take your holy Bible and etc., etc. But, you know, Job, thankfully, was a bit more, was wiser than that. He did have a great deal of integrity. And so he stood his ground, and at no point did he raise up his voice and curse God. But there is a slight change you can see here in verse 6. It says, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. You remember in chapter 1, God said all that he has, all his possessions are in your hand, but leave him alone. Now, it's moved on a bit. Now it says that actually Job is in your hands, but spare his life. So something had changed between chapter 1 and chapter 2. And the take I would put on that is very simply that Job had opened the door even further when he said in chapter 1 verse 21, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord, because now Job believes that God is out to destroy him. Now Job is having faith that God is going to make life more difficult. Job has opened the door even further. Up until this time, Job had a great fear of losing his wealth. He said, the things I greatly feared have happened to me. That which I dreaded has happened to me. But then he says, is God, you know, is God doing this? God's after me. God's reduced me to nothing. And of course, once Job starts to believe that God is out for no good and out for evil, then Job has opened up the door even more, giving Satan even more opportunity against Job. Okay, so let's move on now to God's response, because for about 30 chapters, we've read of Job's friends, although he called them miserable comforters, accusing him of wickedness, and that God was punishing him, and time he repented. And then Job says, no, I'm innocent. God's attacking me without cause. I want to see him in court. I want justice. That was where we left Job. So let's turn to Job chapter 38. Let's see what God made of all these conversations thus far. 38 and verse 1. Then Eternal answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" We said a number of times now, Job's big problem was that he lacked accurate knowledge, as did his three friends. You know, some of the things they said seem fairly sensible to you and I, perhaps, but fundamentally, they didn't understand. They had great gaps in their knowledge. And here's one who had a huge gap in his knowledge, which was Job. This is God's words. He said, "Who is this? Who are you? Who darkens, you actually obscure what is true, Job. You're making it more difficult to see the truth because of your words." And Job was a very wordy man. He said a lot, but God says, "Your words lack knowledge. You don't have a foundation of accurate knowledge, Job." Essentially, Job, you're speaking from a great deal of ignorance, Job. Verse 3, "Now, prepare yourself like a man," you know, stand up straight. "I will question you, and you shall answer me." You know, Job's been saying, "I want to meet God. I want to turn up in court with God. I want a mediator between me and God. I want to present my case before God. I've got a few questions of God." And God says, okay. I think, so reading through these chapters, it doesn't come across that God is being difficult with Job. I suspect God was quite easy in a sense. These were just questions to which God knew there was no answer. And I don't think God was jumping up and down angry with Job. It's just a question of, you know, "Job, you're a child. Let me ask you a few questions." So I think, and probably Job was actually in some ways very relieved that after seeming to be left on his own, suddenly there is contact from the great God being. Anyway, carrying on to verse 4, God says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, who determined its measurements? Surely you know." That's a bit of irony. "Who stretched the line upon it?" You know, who measured the earth and designed planet Earth, Job? Were you around when I put it together and built its foundations? Were you? To which the answer was, no. Verse 6, "To what were its foundations fastened, or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Were you there, Job, thousands of years ago when I designed, measured out, constructed, and built this earth, when the angels sang for joy? Were you there, Job?" No. Verse 8, "Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band?" Verse 12, "Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place?" You know, do you measure and control the circling of the earth? Do you measure the rising and setting of the sun? Do you, Job? Verse 16, "Have you entered the springs of the sea, or have you walked in search of the depths? Have you been down to the depths of the ocean, way down deep, Job? Have you seen the freshwater springs that come out of the seawater, Job? Have you done any of that, Job?" You know. Verse 19, "Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And darkness, where is its place? Do you know where light comes from, Job? Do you know what light is, Job?" You could ask. You could ask the question today, for that matter. Do you know what light is? Is it a wave or a particle? What is light? And God was asking these questions of Job. Verse 22, "Have you entered the treasury of snow? Have you seen the treasury of hail?" Do you know where hail and snow come from? "Which I reserve for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war. By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth?" you know any of these things, Job? So he's really just asking Job a number of basic questions about the earth. Were you here in the beginning, Job? Did you see me make the earth, Job? Do you know how the hail operates, Job? Do you know how the dawn comes round, Job? Do you know how hail is manufactured and stored up, Job? Verse 25, who has divided a channel for the overflowing water or a path of the thunderbolt? Do you know, Job, about that? Because the answer is no. Verse 31, can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? Now here's some constellations in the heavens above, and God says, basically, can you control the constellations? Do you control the stars, Job? Obviously the answer is, because I do. So really, Job, you know, where do you fit in this debate? Interesting, it says here, can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades? The Pleiades are often called the Seven Sisters. In fact, my Marsden's got that. The Seven Sisters, that's a quite attractive little constellation that you can see typically in the winter time, at least from Britain. And unlike many constellations where the stars are just, they look like they're together, but actually they're sort of long distance apart, one going one way and one another way and so on. But the Pleiades are actually a group of stars traveling together through space, a bit like you would see a flock of birds all flying, you know, together in one direction. The Pleiades is several hundred stars, or probably several thousand stars, in a cluster. And it's a real, genuine cluster. They are all traveling together. They're all traveling in the same direction together. So here's somebody claiming to be God, being quoted in the book of Job, and he gives us some information that you couldn't really have known up until recent years, that the Pleiades are actually a cluster. They are bound together. That's not information that, you know, a Jewish writer eating magic mushrooms could have known, you know, 3,000 years ago. Or loose the belt of Orion. Can you bring out Maseroth in its season? Can you guide the great bear with its cubs? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? Can you control the constellations and the stars, Job? Well, no, the answer is no, can't do any of that. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? Can you send out lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Can you control the lightning, Job? The answer is no, can't do any of those things. And so Job's listening and thinking, no, no to that one, no, not to that one, no, not to that one, no, not that one, no, not that one, no, not that one either. And Job's realizing, actually, in terms of knowledge, I don't know an awful lot, do I? And chapter 39, God now turns his attention to a few of the animals on the earth about which, okay, Job, you don't know about the creation of the earth several thousand years ago or longer. You don't know about how lightning forms. You don't know about the ocean depths. You don't know about where hail and so on come from. You don't know about how the constellations are controlled. Let's come right close to Earth, Job, chapter 39. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? I assume the answer from Job was no. Can you mark when the deer gives birth? I suppose Job's answer must have been no. Can you number the months that they fulfill? Do you know the time when they bear young? To which the answer from God is, because I know all these things, Job. Dropping down to verse 9. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great? Will you leave him your labor, or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? Well, presumably a wild ox was a wild ox in those days, and not a beast that you would tame. So, could you tame the wild ox, Job? Which I suspect the answer must have been, actually no, can't do that either. Dropping down to, let's see, verse 19. have you given the horse strength? As it's obviously, that wasn't Job that did that. Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened. Nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage. Nor does he stand firm, because the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet he says, aha! He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting. So here's a war horse, trained for battle, and God says, now Job, was it you that gave this this huge beast this power and this fearless approach, this attitude? Were you the one that made war horses so strong and courageous that they would charge into battle despite the javelins flying and the trumpets blowing? Was that you, Job? Did you give the horses strength? No, that wasn't me. Okay, verse 26 then. Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Okay, did you teach hawks how to fly then, Job? No, that wasn't me. Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? Did you give the eagle those wings that can just, it can sail higher and higher and higher? And even though it's, 1,000 feet up, it can spot a little tiny rodent on the ground and come plummeting down and catch it. Did you do all that, Job? Did you design the eagle and its wings and its flight? Did you? No, that wasn't really me. Okay. Verse of chapter 40. Moreover, the Eternal answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. So here you are, Job, you're finding fault with me, right? It says you're contending with the Almighty, you're rebuking God. Okay, that's what we've been doing all this time, Job, rebuking me, saying I'm wrong, saying I'm doing all these bad things. Okay, right, let's carry on then, Job. Then Job answers the Eternal and said, behold, meaning, oh dear. It means oh, look, what a surprise. I am vile. Now, vile in the Old King James Version English doesn't mean what we think it means nowadays. I think more modern translations say insignificant or lightweight. It means really, oh dear, I am a lightweight, aren't I? Or, oh my, how insignificant I appear to be. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I've spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I'll proceed no further. Nope. I've said it all now. I'm going to be quiet. I'm going to be hushed. So he doesn't want to talk any further to God. I think he sees a bit one-sided, this conversation. And then verse 6, the Eternal answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, come on, prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Big mouth. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me, Job, that you may be justified? Meaning, to prove you're right? Are you going to say I'm wrong, Job, just to prove that you're right? Are you? Have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? Then adorn yourself with majesty and splendor. Array yourself with glory and beauty. Disperse the rage of your wrath. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. Can you do that, Job? Look at everyone who is proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide in the dust together. Bind their faces in hidden darkness. Do all that, Job. And then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. I'll acknowledge your greatness, Job, if you can do all of those things. But of course, Job realized, I can't do any of those things. I can't array myself with glory and beauty. I can't bring down the vain. I can't thunder with a voice like God's. I can't do any of these things. And here I've been busy condemning God. So I'm proven to be right, and really, actually, wow. Oh dear. So God carries on. Let's have a look at another animal, Job. Just see how big you are by comparison. Verse 15. Look now at Behemoth, or Behemoth, which I made along with you. Of course, you get to these creatures, and there's no absolutely definite proof as to what these beasts are. This was a very powerful beast, so powerful that God said, you know, there's nothing else on earth, Job, like this. Look now at the Behemoth, which I've made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now, his strength is in his hips, and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. And many translations say that Behemoth is a hippopotamus, which seems incredibly unlikely, because if you've ever seen a hippo, his tail does not resemble a cedar. You know, a cedar, particularly a cedar of Lebanon, is a very, very big tree, and you know, the branches of a cedar can be easily, you know, 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet in diameter, whereas a hippo's tail is like a bit of rope, really, a bit of string. So this is not, I think, a hippo. People aren't too sure what it is. There are some quite good guesses at some type of what we would class as perhaps a dinosaur of some sort. But he moves his tail like a cedar, so think of a tail that's perhaps a foot or two or three in diameter, stretched out horizontally for maybe 20, 30 feet. There are some dinosaur-type creatures that are very much like that. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze. His ribs like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Or one translation says, he's the most amazing of all my creatures. So potentially a giant dinosaur type creature, perhaps 40, 50, 60 feet long, 70 feet long, perhaps standing 30, 40, 50 feet high, with a tail stretching out like a cedar of Lebanon. And of course, you know, Job was familiar with this creature because, says verse 15, I made it along with you. He is the first of the ways of God, verse 19. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. You know, I'm the only person, says God, that can get close to him. Surely the mountains yield food for him, and all the beasts of the field play there. He lies under the lotus trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus trees cover him with their shade. The willows by the brooks around him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he is not disturbed, even in the most, you know, serious of storms and floods. Not bothered. Far too big for that. He is confident, even though the Jordan gushes into his mouth. Though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare. So God's basically saying, Job, you want to contend with me. You couldn't even contend with Behemoth. He's far too big and powerful and frightening for you. You can't contend with a creature I've made. You want to contend with me, do you? So Job thinks, yeah, right. Behemoth, too big. Oh, but God made him. Oh, God's even bigger. All right. Then chapter 41, another major creature that God decides to sort of say, okay, Job, here's another one for you. You know, I've just given you the biggest, most powerful land animal on the earth that Job is familiar with, some dinosaur type of creature. Now I'll give you one in the oceans. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook, or snare his tongue with a line which you lure? Now some translations reckon that this might be a crocodile, which is no way is it a crocodile, as we can see. Can you put a reed through his nose, or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Can you have some sort of can you tame or have an agreement with a Leviathan? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Will you leash him for your maidens? You know, put a lead round him and, you know, bring him along to show off to your maidens and servants. People have done it with crocodiles. People like, you know, Crocodile Dundee and so on. I've seen people wrestling with crocodiles and alligators. You wouldn't wrestle with a Leviathan. Verse 6, will your companions make a banquet of him? Verse 7, can you fill his skin with harpoons, or his head with fishing spears? Can you? The answer is no. Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is vain. You can't capture Leviathan. You can capture crocodiles. Shall one not be overwhelmed at the very sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me, Job? Job, you couldn't take on for a moment Leviathan. You know, you are puny by comparison to Leviathan. Nobody on the earth can take on Leviathan. You won't take on me? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine. I'm the master of Behemoth. I'm the master of Leviathan. They're all mine. I will not conceal or keep stand about his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? His rows of scales are his pride, shut up as tightly as with a seal. One is so near another that no air can come between them. This is a scary and a scaly monster. They are joined one to another, they stick together and cannot be parted. His sneezings flash forth light. His eyes are like the eyelids of the morning, you know, they glow. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils, as from a boiling pot, and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. It's some crocodile this is. Interestingly, in the Greek Old Testament, the word is dragon. This is a dragon, and one imagines that the stories we've read in the, you know, mythology and fairy tales about dragons breathing fire, almost certainly based upon some creature like this. And of course, there are some strange creatures on the earth. There are lots of sea creatures who do glow. They are luminescent. They have colours and lights, even down deep. There are eels, which are electric and can, you know, discharge a heavy charge and can stun or even kill a person. There are little bombardier beetles that can fire out, you know, boiling liquids which are toxic and so on. Was there ever a creature who could ignite and fire out flames? I'll put one in it saying yes, there probably was, and this would be him. Strength dwells in his neck, sorrow danceth before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together, they are firm on him and cannot be moved. His heart is as hard as stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. Because of his crashings, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw, and bronze as rotten wood. You can't get this guy, or girl, whichever it was, with swords and spears and things of that nature. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts, he regards as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. Verse 31, he makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. If you imagine this huge creature and it just racing through the water's all churning up like boiling water. He leaves a shining wake behind him. One would think the deep had white hair. So he just charges through the water and it's all bubbling and boiling and frothing and all foam at the top. And on earth there is nothing like him which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. And Job, can you control him? Did you make him? Can you contend with him? No. So Job listened to all this and Job realizes that actually he knows so far essentially nothing. Now, I suppose before we leave, this is a tiny bit of speculation, because does God ever explain to Job about Satan and how it was that Satan was the one who was bringing all the trouble to Job? And the answer is that it's not clear, but chapter 41 and Leviathan could well be a symbolic reference to Satan. If you think of Revelation 12:9, let's just turn there for a moment. Revelation 12:9, hold your place Revelation 12:9, because Leviathan could be a symbolic term as well as being a real creature for the devil, for Satan. Revelation 12:9 you'd be quite familiar with, I think, but notice some of the expressions here. So the great dragon was cast out. Dragon, that's what the Greek for Leviathan is. Draken, dragon. The great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old. Well, again, Leviathan is translated by some translators as serpent. And he obviously is a sea serpent of some sort. So Leviathan can be dragon. Leviathan can be serpent. Those are both perfectly acceptable translations. So here it says, the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. So Satan is a dragon and a serpent, could be called Leviathan perhaps. Let's turn to Isaiah 26. Isaiah chapter 26, to a prophecy for shortly ahead of us. Just to see that Leviathan could be a code name for Satan, as well as clearly a rather powerful sea beast of some sort. Again, some sort of sea creature from that we would class as a dinosaur type of creature. Well, because dinosaurs are lizards, and this probably wasn't. Chapter 26 of Isaiah and verse 20, a prophecy of physical salvation coming up for God's people. Come, my people, enter your chambers and shut your doors behind you. Hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment until the indignation is past. Please be talking about the coming tribulation and God's people being hidden until that is over. Verse 21, for behold, the Eternal comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth will also disclose her blood and will no more cover her slain. So God's coming out of his place to punish the earth. Chapter 27 and verse 1. In that day, that's an expression that typically means in the day of the Lord, day of God's intervention. In that day, Eternal with his severe sword, great and strong, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, that twisted serpent, and he will slay the reptile that is in the sea. So here it says, in the future, after the indignation is past, when God intervenes in world affairs to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity, in that day, it says God will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, that twisted serpent, and he will slay the reptile that is in the sea. Well, I don't imagine God's going to be too bothered about any reptiles in the sea, but Satan is that great dragon and that serpent of old. And this is happening in the future. Look at verse 13. So it shall be in that day that the great trumpet will be blown, and they will come who are about to perish in the land of Assyria, and they are outcasts in the land of Egypt, and shall worship the Eternal in the holy mount at Jerusalem. So somewhere in the near future, you know, a great Leviathan, a fleeing twisted serpent, is going to be slain by God, or neutralized by God. And so Leviathan could well be an indicator of Satan. So perhaps, this is speculation, in Job 41, if we turn back there, it may well be that God's actually giving Job a coded message, that you couldn't take on Leviathan physically, Job, nor can you take on Job the spiritual Leviathan, that twisted serpent, Satan, because he's really the one behind all these problems. Okay, let's turn to Job 42. So at this point, you know, God's pretty much finished. He hasn't really berated Job particularly heavily. He's asked Job a whole bunch of questions to which Job knew none of the answers. So score on his test, 0 out of 100. Job 42, verse 1, then Job answered the Eternal and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. I admit I have been ignorant. I admit I didn't understand. It was really all beyond me. I was so sure that you were attacking me, and I was so sure I could take on my three friends, but actually I just realized I know nothing. Verse 4. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. Well, I have heard of you in the past by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. You know, I've heard of you before. You know, I thought I knew about you, but I didn't. But now I understand. Now I see. And he says, therefore I abhor myself. Now, that word abhor, it's myself is in italics, so it doesn't say I abhor anything, just is blank at that point. And some say the word abhor can be translated repudiate or retract. And what Job may well be saying is, therefore I repudiate everything I've said. Not I abhor myself, but I repudiate or retract what I've said. And repent, it says, in dust and ashes. Well, the word for repent appears 7 times in the book of Job. The other 6 places it's translated as comfort. So exactly why they want to translate it as repent when it always is translated comfort, 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 comfort. And it probably means here, verse 6, therefore I repudiate all I've said, and I'm comforted in dust and ashes, because I know you now. That's a comfort to me. I know you. Now I feel better. Now I understand. Now I see it. Now I know you. So face to face. And that was a great comfort to Job. And so Job finally got enough of the point to be a very happy some man. Although he still, of course, no children and no wealth. But of course, as we saw before, the three friends are busy. Now, how much of this they heard, I don't know. Script doesn't say whether they overheard the conversation or whether it was private between God and Job. I suspect it was private. But verse 7, and so it was after the Eternal had spoken these words to Job, that the Eternal said to Eliphaz the Temanite, and he was the elder of the three, their spokesman, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken me what was right, as my servant Job has. And Job barely did that. But God says, you three, wow, you are in serious trouble, because you said some terrible things about me, and also, for that matter, about my servant Job. And God was not impressed. Now therefore, verse 8, take for yourselves 7 bulls and 7 rams, go to my servant Job, offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for I'll accept him, you know, not you lot, lest I deal with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken to me what is right, as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz, the Temanite, and Bildad, and Zophar went and did as the Eternal commanded them, for the Eternal had accepted Job, and the Eternal restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends. And you can imagine this wasn't easy necessarily for anybody to do, because Job's three friends had thought they were so right. Even, don't forget, Eliphaz had a vision from a spirit in the night. He knew he was right. He did a message from heaven. These three guys had sort of torn strips off of Job. They knew they were right. They knew they were God's spokespeople. And here God says, you are in serious trouble. You better get Job to pray for you or you're out of here. And so they'd be shocked by God's correction of them, stunned probably, and they have to humble themselves because they've just told Job what a wicked, iniquitous, hypocritical thief and vagabond he was. Oh, Job, would you mind praying for us, please? Right? And then what about Job? He could think, you three scumbags, you miserable sinners, not praying for you. No, clear off. So both the three friends and Job had a bit of sorting out to do. Easier, I suspect, for Job. But, you know, how long had all this gone on? Well, I won't turn to the scriptures, but the conversation between Job and his three friends, we've only got, I guess, the high points, or the low points, if you prefer, recorded. But even so, you can't imagine it took, you know, too long for the debate to run its course. Kind of too long before you fed up saying you're a sinner, Job. And before Job says, no, 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 I'm not. Now, it probably would have lasted no more than a very few months. If you want to look at it separately, try Job 7 verses 1 to 3. Job 7 verses 1 to 3, we're not going to turn there. And Job 29 verses 1 to 6. And what you'll see in those two passages is that Job talks about a few months ago, when life was wonderful for me, a few months ago, not years ago, but a few months back. And he says in one place, you know, I've been sort of sentenced to months of hardship. You know, so it may have been 2 months, 6 weeks, 3 months, we don't know. It certainly wasn't, you know, a lifetime. It was a fairly brief period. You know, some people today think that they're like Job. You know, I'm going through some suffering just like Job. You know, God's brought this on me just like he did on Job. Well, the answer is no. No, they're not. But, you know, even if you were like Job, right, I don't believe for a moment anybody is, but even if you were hypothetically being treated just like Job, that's great news, because Job's suffering lasted only a few months, maybe 2 or 3 months. And then Job was blessed with double what he had to start with. So anybody who goes through Job's experience, which will be nobody by the way, but if one did hypothetically, great. You can look forward to being blessed with twice as much as you had to start with, and it'll all be over in just a few months, maybe 2, 3, 4 months. But of course, nobody is going through Job's experience. Job 42, and let's pick up in verse 10 again. Eternal restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends. Indeed, the Eternal gave Job twice as much as he had before. Well, that's the way God always was. You know, God had blessed Job to start with, and now when God's back involved, he blesses Job even more. It's only when Satan was involved for a brief period of perhaps 2, 3 months or something, that Job's calamities came upon him, but now it's restored twice. So it's a great ending for Job. Then all his brothers, all his sisters, and all those who had been his acquaintances before came to him and had food with him in his house, and they consoled him and comforted him for all the adversity that the Lord had brought upon him, as they saw in their eyes. Each one gave him a piece of silver and a ring of gold. But I mean, think about this. His brothers, his sisters, his acquaintances had taken off. When he was in a bad way, his three friends were there, but what about his brothers? Not to be seen. His sisters, sorry, we don't know a Job. His acquaintances, Job? No, I don't think I recognize that name. But of course, once his wealth is returning, then like bees to honey, or flies to a dustbin, whichever you prefer, up they come. You know, fickle, that's what people are. As far as they're concerned, of course, this is all God's doing. Verse 12, now the Eternal blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning, for he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 female donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters, so restored there what he'd lost. So all of this would have taken I guess the number of years altogether, unless he had 6 duplets or something, but it would have taken a few years to have his entire family, if you like, restored to him, and his wealth and so on. And he called the name of the first daughter Jemima, name of the second Keziah or Keziah, and the name of the third Keren Hapuk. In all the land were found no women so beautiful as the daughters of Job, and their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. After this, Job lived 140 years, and saw his children and grandchildren for 4 generations. So Job died old and full of days. So that's a good ending for Job. maybe a 2 or 3 months of calamity, 4 months, 5 months, it doesn't say, but it is months, and then he is restored double-fold. And you could speculate again here when it says that Job lived, verse 16, 140 years after this. If God blessed Job with double what he had before, that might imply that Job was about 70 when his calamities struck, when he opened the door and let Satan waltz right in and kick him all over the place, because that would be 70 years up till then, and then God blessed him with perhaps double, not 140, meaning that Job died somewhere around about age, what, 210 or something like that. So as it says, verse 17, Job died old and full of days. So what can we sort of summarize then about the book of Job? What can we learn today, some thousands of years later? Well, Job was clearly an upright and blameless man. But his good life did not protect him from Satan's attacks. And neither will yours. Even assuming for a moment that you are as good as Job was, and I suspect many of us wouldn't fall in that category, because Job never responded by, you know, cursing God. And if God said Job's a blameless man, well, I guess he was. Most of our problems in life tend to be self-induced. But just as Job was attacked by Satan, you and I can be. If there's one lesson that you and I do need to learn, it is that God's given us the authority, the warnings, the instructions to protect us. If we walk in his word, we can be safe from Satan. If we don't do what God says, we can't rely on just being a good church member to protect us, because it won't. It did not protect Job. It did not protect, it will not protect those in Revelation 12 who are attacked by Satan at the end, even though they are commandment keepers. Let's turn finally to 1 Peter chapter 5. First letter of Peter, chapter 5, and we'll begin in verse 6. First Peter, chapter 5, and beginning verse 6. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. He cared for Job throughout. But verse 8 is the one to focus on. Be sober, be vigilant or watchful, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Now that is reality. That is not just Peter writing to fill out this letter, make it look religious or something. This is reality. God said to Satan way back in Job 1 and 2, where have you been? Well, I've been walking to and I've been walking fro. I've been seeking here, I've been seeking there. And I found somebody called Job. And here it's the same. It says, verse 8, be sober, be vigilant. Now, if you and I are not vigilant, if we are not watchful, then it says our adversary, that's opponent, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. There are some that he may devour, not because God sets them up to be devoured, because they're not being vigilant, they're not being sober, they're not humbling themselves under the mighty hand of God. And Satan is looking for such people who have stepped out of the protection, people who are wandering out there, and as a roaring lion he's looking for them. And it says, verse 9, resist him, steadfast in the faith, or in faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. You know, Satan's out there looking for some whom he may devour. In the case of Job, he did some devouring before God intervened. And of course, I think we understand Job knew a lot less in his day than you and I know today. We have the benefit of the whole Bible, from Genesis to Revelation. We have the Holy Spirit of God. And we have the name of the Lord Jesus Christ to use in battle. So we are far better off, far better equipped to succeed in victory than Job was. So, your job and my job is to be vigilant, to wear our armor, to give no place or opportunity to the devil at any time. And certainly one thing is, don't ever blame God for the consequences of our mistakes or for Satan's attacks. That is not ever going to be the right thing to do. Okay, brethren, with that we'll conclude our study of the book of Job.